Hello, welcome to The Wire, where fresh coverage of independent news and current affairs from right around Australia comes to you on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on the program today...
Insects are declining in the well-studied temperate regions, Europe and North America. And in those places, there's a whole range of factors that are affecting the decline of insects.
Challenging times as tropical insect and butterfly populations are in decline due to climate-fueled El Niño weather events. Stay tuned for this story and more coming up on The Wire. But first, President Trump and President Putin are set to meet this Friday in Alaska to discuss a pathway for peace in the Russian and Ukrainian war. The White House has tempered expectations for the summit, claiming the meeting is a listening exercise. Russia has emphasized the ceasefire will need to involve Ukrainian territorial concessions, resulting in pushback from President Zelensky and the European community. George Popel has the story.
President Trump and President Putin are set to meet this Friday in Alaska, marking the first time a US president has met with Putin since 2021. While the talk is aimed at achieving a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine, experts are pessimistic about the summit. Dr. Sonia Majacek is a professor at the Centre of European Studies at the Australian National University. She believes the talk is undermined from the outset by not including President Zelensky.
It is really unrealistic to go ahead and hold peace talks without the victim. Zelensky himself for several days now has been saying that these talks will be stillborn. That's the word that he uses. They just won't go anywhere unless Ukraine is at the table as well. And of course, European partners have put together, or they're preparing, I believe, a statement, and they are going to be saying the same thing. But anything that's discussing Ukraine needs to involve Ukraine at the table.
The exclusion of Zelensky could also result in Trump being manipulated by Putin.
There seems to be fear, certainly within Ukraine, that a Putin will provide a whole lot of disinformation, basically, and a lot of misinformation, the sort of thing that he's been saying, that historically this is always part of Russia anyway. That sort of thing can be very manipulative. And there's fear that Trump personally will simply listen to that and buy into that. And of course, that's the kind of disinformation that Zelensky would be able to stop and challenge immediately on the spot. So in my view, Putin is actually rather threatened by meeting Zelensky in person.
Russia has put the pressure on Ukraine to concede territory for a ceasefire to be agreed to. However, Ukraine has argued this violates their constitution.
The constitution defines the Ukrainian territory, and Zelensky has been saying that he can't even agree to anything like that without changes to the constitution. Further to that, he's been saying Ukrainians will not gift their land. It would be simply rewarding Russia for what it's done. And to go into a little bit more detail, what's apparently on the table is the Donetsk region. And the problem is that that eastern region, if that were to go in entirety to Russia, it would actually close down the military defense lines that Ukraine has there. And that means that that would just open the way for Russia to attack further into Ukraine. You know, to sort of rearm, take a break, and then attack further. And Zelensky has actually said that as well.
Experts are concerned that if Trump reaches a deal with Russia, he will place undue pressure on Ukraine to agree.
I think rewarding Russia for what it's done would be a very dangerous move for the rest of the world. But I do fear that that's what may happen. Many people within Ukraine fear that Trump will try to pressure Zelensky into accepting a deal which really is advantageous for Russia. I think it will depend on European leaders really stepping up and supporting Zelensky in not accepting that kind of deal.
The European community are also anxious about the upcoming talks, particularly as there is a fear that if Russia is successful in Ukraine, other neighbouring countries may come under risk of Russian invasion.
If Russia is successful, if Ukraine is militarily defeated, that then poses a threat for the rest of Europe. Putin has openly said that he wants to reinstate the Russian Empire. He wants to reconquer areas that, of course, now are independent countries. He wants to take control of those areas again. And that means Moldova, that means Poland, that means Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. They are the next countries up for grab if Ukraine is defeated.
Dr. Sonia Michak of the Australian National University Centre for European Studies speaking there with George Popel. Tasmanian Premier Jeremy Rockcliffe announced on Sunday that greyhound racing will be phased out in Tasmania by 2029. In his announcement, the Premier cited concerns about the future of the industry and animal welfare as some of the reasoning behind his decision. Maeve Groom asked CEO of RSPCA Tasmania, Andrea Dawkins, how the organisation reacted to the news.
Absolute delight. Shock and awe. Actually, we knew that because of the current circumstances in the Tasmanian Parliament that negotiations were underway. And I guess for many of us, we saw the cessation of greyhound racing as in some ways an easy win for one of the leaders of parties that needed to negotiate with the Greens in order to be able to continue to form a parliament. And then when we heard the news that greyhounds would be saved from the racing industry, should the Premier be able to maintain his position, we were absolutely thrilled. There were many tears, of course, in that kind of 24 hours. It was just delight. And since then, we've been working through some of the more complex issues around the phase out of greyhound racing.
What do you think has driven this change for the Premier to finally decide now is the time to transition out of the greyhound racing industry?
Look, I think three things have happened. The ban and phase out from New Zealand, that's a very, very strong message from our neighbours. There was a report by renowned economist Saul Eslake, which showed that the level of funding that greyhound racing was receiving in Tasmania was much higher than for any other jurisdiction. It was clear that it's an industry that cannot stand on its own two feet. And then there was the awful death of Raiders Guide in Launceston a couple of weeks ago. That was the most horrendous thing to witness. So awful. This dog that had been raced so many times and won thousands of dollars for its owners to die so unceremoniously. I think that was really the last straw. And we certainly hope that sacrifice was for something.
So the Premier did cite these welfare concerns for both participants and mainly the animals as one of the reasons for this decision. For those who may not know, could you elaborate a bit more on some of these wider concerns about the industry?
Well, the greyhound industry in Tasmania certainly doesn't have the money funneled into it that perhaps other jurisdictions in the country do. When we've seen activist footage, drone footage taken of some of the larger establishments, it's very clear that the animals are kept in the barest of minimum conditions. We see some waterlogged pens. There's no bedding. There didn't seem to be any free-flowing water. The dogs were alone in these pens. They are not socialised. They are only brought out to train and to run. And certainly for the level of funding that the greyhound racing industry was getting, the standard of care was very poor.
And in terms of the transition into this phase-out period, what are the expectations for the communities directly involved in the racing industry? Do you know what this might look like for both participants and the greyhounds themselves?
We are asking for and have been asking for some years for a just transition for both the participants and for the dogs. So that would look like funding going towards people to be able to exit the industry, but also funding going towards the animal welfare organisations and rescue organisations who will be tasked with rehoming these dogs. Because, of course, these dogs come out of the industry generally unsocialised. Often they've not been in and out of cars, they've not walked up and downstairs. There's lots that needs to be worked through in order for a safe transition for both dogs and people. And the Premier had announced that the Commissioner for Racing Integrity would be overseeing that period with a parliamentary committee set up, which we hope to have a seat at.
Are there concerns that despite the ban on this federal funding to the racing industry, that it may continue behind closed doors or in a private setting? Will there be a way to monitor this at all?
Oh, absolutely. Look, Tasmania is a small island. We have a pretty good network of animal welfare advocates. We don't believe that this will be set up in any way in Tasmania once this phase out is complete. What the RSPCA does not want to see is animals being sold into other jurisdictions and racing elsewhere. That completely defies the rationale behind this phase out. And we want every single animal that's in Tasmania to be rehomed into a loving home.
CEO of RSPCA Tasmania, Andrea Dawkins, speaking there with Maeve Groom. Mapping technology was used in a study in Vanuatu designed to combat the ravages of climate change. It was found that whilst coffee crops are facing challenges, cocoa could be a great replacement crop. I asked Dr. Leanne Webb, science lead for the CSIRO Asia Pacific Climate Intelligence Team at the annual Crawford Fund conference in Parliament House, Canberra, to explain the CSIRO findings.
So this study was undertaken in Vanuatu, and we were looking at quite a few crops, but two of them were cocoa and coffee, where we looked at into the future, into the period around 2050, to see where these crops might be best suited for growing under the warming climate conditions. So we use GIS mapping, so we can look at the temperature into the future. It was mainly temperature that was driving these changes. So for cocoa, currently where you grow cocoa, it can't be too cold and it can't be too hot. All right, so we mapped where is the likely best climate for cocoa. And into the future, it was interesting because the areas where it's currently too cold is actually where it ameliorated. So you can now grow cocoa there in under a warmer climate. So what we found for cocoa is an increase in suitability across the whole archipelago, pretty much. There was shifting, of course. Some places became too hot, but many places became more suitable.
And this is a way that people are going to be able to deal with climate change or warming particularly, because then you're looking at, well, something's going to go wrong with these current crops, but we've got these other ones that maybe you could move to.
Yeah, so that was the winner. That was kind of like the commodity that is gaining in suitability. Coffee, however, is losing suitability in Vanuatu because it's going to become too hot in many regions for where coffee is already growing.
Now, this is very simplistic, but I thought, well, you know, couldn't you move up the hill a bit where the altitude gives you a cooler climate, or is that not going to work?
So for coffee in Vanuatu, it's already growing in one of the cooler parts in the most or second most southern island called Tanna. And it's a really already a cool area. So it's kind of like it's just getting a little bit too cool in the future warming climate. However, where the coffee might be less suitable, there might be opportunities to plant cocoa in future, for example. Now, these are all just a guide, and there's all sorts of microclimates and other climate variables and soil that we have assumed just are always suitable, right? So we're just looking at temperature suitability here. We have to be careful in saying that.
Because there could be changes in rainfall and other things like that, exactly. You know, more cyclones. So, you know, that's going to affect the types of crops too, isn't it?
Exactly. So in saying that cocoa will become more suitable and coffee less suitable, we're not talking about other climate factors like tropical cyclones, like sea level rise, although these crops tend to grow in much more elevated regions, so less affected by sea level rise. But yes, so it's a very simple analysis and is used as a guide to help with regional planning.
And this is part of a program the CSIRO has, and if that's the case, what else are you going to be looking at?
Okay, so this is part of one project. It's actually delivered by SPREP, which is a Pacific organisation that coordinates all of these projects. We've also done at CSIRO work in Papua New Guinea and Samoa, looking at coffee and cocoa as well.
Yes, I noticed in the presentation just now that the PNG were particularly, they talked about coffee as well. Coffee's quite big around a lot of these smaller countries too, aren't they? They're looking to go to coffee.
Yeah, so from memory, for Papua New Guinea, the coffee growing is actually moving to more elevated parts of Papua New Guinea. It's already grown in the highlands there. So yeah, it's another interesting study, but we also did some mapping for there. So this kind of mapping approach is a really good guide for regional planning, because using quite simple metrics, you can get an indication that something might be less or more suitable for growing under the changed climate conditions, like out to 2030.
That sounds like there's some hope for people when we are worried about what might happen for the future. You've got some sort of a pathway then, haven't you?
There's definitely options for going forward that we're trying to explore more with all the different crops that can be grown. That's for sure.
Dr. Leanne Webb, Science Lead for the CSIRO Asia Pacific Climate Intelligence Team, speaking with me there at the annual Crawford Fund Conference in Parliament House, Canberra.
Whenever I want to catch up with current affairs in Australia, I head to thewire.org.au or I follow them on Twitter. I just search for The Wire Radio, all one word. And yes, they're on Facebook too.
Insects play an important role for our planet. They're responsible for carrying out duties such as acting as pollinators for plants, decomposing and being food sources for other animals. But due to El Niño weather events, there is a big decline in insect populations, particularly in tropical insects and butterfly populations. Thomas Kutis asked Emeritus Professor Nigel Stork from Griffith University what inspired him and his team to conduct this study.
So we've known for quite a long time, scientists known for a long time, that insects are declining in the well-studied temperate regions, Europe and North America. And in those places, there's a whole range of factors that are affecting the decline of insects. It's hard to pinpoint exactly which ones are doing what, but it's pollution, land conversion, and a whole range of, as I say, range of things. What we've done is to pick studies where they're in virtually pristine rainforests around the world. So we ruled out all those other factors. And what we're looking then at is the potential impacts of climate. Okay, and then we modeled what is happening with those 80 studies. And they're across a whole range of different groups. So they're not necessarily all done the same way, but different groups of insects. And we found that we could detect a strong signal that in the El Niño years, which are often the drier ones across the tropics, there was a decline in the diversity and abundance of those insects, butterflies, beetles, and so on. And normally in La Niña years, which are wetter, then the insects rebound and recover in terms of the numbers of individuals. But we're finding that there's an increasing intensity of El Niños and increasing frequency. And we believe that's what causing a decline in those insects, and it's hard to get out of that decline.
Your research highlights declines in butterflies, beetles, and true bugs. What ecological roles do these insects play, and what are the broader consequences of a disappearance?
Well, I think crucially, it's the butterflies are very well studied by comparison to a lot of the other insects groups. There are more people who work on butterflies than there are on all the others. So that's why we found that there were more butterfly studies. Butterflies, though, the crucial thing is when they're larvae, they chew the leaves. They don't tend to do too much when they're adults. They may do some pollination, some taking of nectar. Beetles are far more diverse, and they range from things which are predators, things which eat leaves, things which eat fungi, and in things which break down leaf litter and so on. So we can be pretty confident that some of those effects are going across all those different functional groups. And beetles are pretty well studied too.
And why are rare insect species particularly vulnerable to climate-fueled El Niño events? And why aren't they recovering during the La Niña cycles as they used to? You know, like it's raining all the time. Why isn't it making any difference?
Well, they may well recover at some stage, but the point is, the species that have small populations are more vulnerable to the huge reductions and possible extinctions of those populations, and possible extinction of the all the populations of a particular species. So they're particularly vulnerable, I would say.
Nigel Stork, Emeritus Professor in the Centre for Planetary Health and Food Security at Griffith University, speaking there with Thomas Kutas. China is on track to become the world's first electrostate. The nation has put its economic power behind renewable technologies, accelerating the end of the fossil fuel era, and now primarily it relies on hydro, wind and solar to create electricity, which has an impact already on emissions. Ruby Ward asked Dr. Roger Dargaville from Monash University whether he was shocked at China's quick turnaround.
China has been leading the way in installing renewables for quite a long time now, and they install more wind and solar annually than the rest of the world combined. So it's no surprise that trend is continuing, and that's not really new news. It's also important to recognise that China, as well as building the most renewables, also produces more electricity from fossil fuel than any other country. So their coal-fired generators are still a very substantial part of their energy mix. Their coal-fired power stations account for almost half of their electricity generation still. They have ambition to decarbonise their electricity sector and to electrify industrial uses of fossil fuel so that their carbon emissions go down. But they've, like many other countries in the world, they have a long way to go. Many countries in the world have announced zero net carbon targets by 2050, 2060, 2070, depending on where they are and what their starting point is. So announcing that you're going to become an electrostate and decarbonize your electricity sector is not really a new thing. But for China, it's extremely important. It's still a very noteworthy announcement because China is the largest user of energy on the planet by a long way. And so when they have intentions to decarbonize and to electrify, that is very important.
Yeah. Do you think Australia will learn from their kind of turnaround into renewables, and what do you think our response will be?
Well, you might be surprised to learn that Australia actually has a higher portion of renewables in its mix at the moment than China. So the uptake of wind and solar as a portion of our total electricity is higher in Australia by a substantial margin. And we're on a faster trend towards decarbonising. Our coal use peaked more than 10 years ago. And our uptake of renewables is expanding rapidly. Now, the scale that we're operating at obviously is much, much smaller than China. Our population is a 50th of the size, so we don't compete in the same league. But in terms of how you manage a system with high penetration renewables, Australia probably can teach China a thing or two. If you look at precincts such as South Australia, where the penetration of renewables in the electricity sector is more than 70%, it cuts both ways. While Australia can learn from the manufacturing scale that China achieves and the incredibly low costs they achieve, the management of a high penetration renewable energy system, Australia actually leads the world in some respects.
So does that mean maybe the new age of the electricity could be upon us as well?
We are definitely on the trajectory to electrifying our industry. And the electricity sector is decarbonising quite quickly. And by 2035, we should be up to around about 80% of our electricity generated from renewables. And that's not very far away. So that sector is electrifying very nicely. Transport is a little way behind, and then you've got the really difficult to abate sectors such as steel making, concrete. These are sectors where minimising carbon emissions are very difficult because it requires brand new technologies that are not commercially viable yet, such as green steel with hydrogen or alternative concrete solutions that don't emit carbon. When you do have the cost of carbon included, then the low carbon solution is often more cost effective, if not now, not far into the future. So even without significant subsidies. As long as the carbon is priced, the system should naturally evolve to decarbonisation and electrification.
Dr. Roger Dargaville, lead researcher in renewable energy at the Monash University Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering, speaking there with Ruby Ward. And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au or subscribe to our podcasts. Just look for The Wire Radio. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 here in Sydney and broadcast around the nation on the Community Radio Network. In Sydney, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well and thanks for your company.